Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Wednesday. It's July 1st, 49 degrees here in Old Town Park City. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, Erica Martin. Good morning.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Leslie. Conditions for today are going to be so pretty. It's finally going to feel more like summer today. We're seeing low 70s in the forecast, a high of 72 degrees, overnight lows in the low 50s. Now, we're going to see lots of sunshine for today, but we do have a cold front that's going to increase wind speed. So for the second half of the day, we're going to see winds top out at about 12 to 20 miles per hour, especially by this evening. So we're definitely keeping an eye on fire weather. That's the big concern these days. Relative humidity is very low. In fact, right now, humidity is at 55%, current temperature in the low 50s. So if we were to kind of take all this into consideration, we'd have to lower the temperature, the dew point, to 34 degrees. So when we look at a dew point, we say, okay, this is how low the temperature would have to go for that thermal profile to be actually all saturated. So in this case, that tells me that the atmosphere is very dry. So just a heads up there, please be aware of your surroundings. Now, with that said, have fun and enjoy. Mostly sunny skies on Thursday, a high of 80 degrees and 81 on Friday. Overnight lows are going to be a lot warmer. We're seeing 52 on Thursday, and we're going to hit mid to upper 50s on Friday. For July 4th, we're also seeing low to mid 80s, so a great day in the forecast. That's probably my biggest concern, especially for any firecrackers, fire, you know, works, anything like that. Very dry conditions. Keep that in mind. On Sunday, we're going to see 80s again. 85 is your expected high, and then 84 on Monday, and we get a little bit cooler on Tuesday, what I mean a little bit, just by 1 degree. So we're still keeping it in the 80s. So starting on Saturday, we're going to see temperatures in the 80s from there on out for the next couple of days. So a really great stretch. Just our big concern is fire weather.
Okay, Erica, thanks. KPCW News Time now, 8:08. It's 8:08. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Stay tuned. I'll be introducing you to the new CEO of Utah Symphony and Opera, Steve Brosvick. Also be talking with Park City resident Cheryl Soschek. She responds to the new plans for the Park City Senior Center. And finally, Summit Community Gardens Executive Director Sloan Johnson with an update on the gardens. Stay tuned for that. Also coming up right after the local news hour, it's The Mountain Life. Today's guests include Meredith Feynman, who is an entrepreneur, writer, and speaker. Also the CEO of Fine Point. This is a leadership and professional development company that elevates individuals and particularly women to an upward trajectory. Then local Olympian Liz Steven joins the show to discuss what a former international cross-country skiing competitor does now to keep herself fit and healthy. Well, we heard a while ago a power outage in the Snyderville Basin. Rocky Mountain Power says more than 1,000 customers are without electricity due to a problem at the Snyderville substation. That's near the Utah Olympic Park. Apparently one circuit went out before 4 o'clock this morning and had not been turned down. Two other circuits went out around 6:30 this morning, but came on just after 10, 15 minutes. Still with one circuit down, apparently thousands of customers still without power. We'll update that as soon as we get more information about it. Well, Wasatch County Council meets this afternoon at 3 o'clock. KPCW's David Boyle reports that the council will discuss the coronavirus, wells, and watershed plans.
Wasatch County Council will begin their meeting by receiving an update from the County Health Department on COVID-19. According to the Health Department, Wasatch County has had 408 cases of the disease. Of those cases, 72 are active, 333 are recovered, and 3 have passed away. The Health Department is distributing print materials and posters throughout the county, encouraging residents to wear masks, practice social distancing, and stay home when sick. At the meeting, the council will also discuss a proposal that would change some restrictions on wells in the county. Current Wasatch County Code does not allow for a well to be placed on a lot that is less than 5 acres. A proposed amendment would allow a property of 4 acres or larger to use a well for culinary water. The code change would most directly impact properties located on the northwest side of the valley along River Road and west of the Provo River. The property owner requesting the change says it's cost prohibitive to build and connect to public water systems at his location near River Road. The rule change could possibly result in more rural development in the unincorporated county. County staff has determined the change is not in line with the current general plan. The council can amend the general plan once a year in November unless an expedited process is necessary. Council will also consider adopting a watershed inventory plan for the county in an effort to maintain water quality in the county and for downstream users. Additionally, they will consider approving a bid for consulting work to update transportation goals and policies in the county's general plan. The consultant is paid for by a grant from UDOT with a portion paid by the Mountain Lands Association of Governments. government. I'm David Boyle, KPCW News.
Local Democrats were called on to vote in the only Summit County community government race on yesterday's primary ballot. In response, voters elected Snyderville resident Melina Stevens to the county council by a resounding margin. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more on that, as well as some other results in yesterday's voting.
Melina Stevens and Candace Hart, who served together on the Snyderville Planning Commission, competed in the Democratic primary to fill the council seat being vacated by Kim Carson. In Tuesday's unofficial results, Stevens received 1,821 votes, nearly 1,000 votes ahead of Hart, who received 831. No Republican contender has filed to run for Carson's seat, so barring a write-in, Stevens has been elected to the Summit County Council. The other contests on primary election day were mostly Republican races for national, state, and state legislative positions. In most of the contests, the overall winners were also the candidates chosen by Summit County Republicans, but there were a couple of exceptions. In the primary race for governor, former Governor John Huntsman won Summit County with nearly 2,700 votes, with three other contenders never topping 1,000 votes. Statewide, though, Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cotts holds a slim lead with about 37% of the vote. Huntsman is in second place with about 34%. In the GOP race for House District 54, Park City resident Randy Favero won in Summit County with 825 votes to 437 for Heber resident Mike Kohler. However, District 54 is primarily in Wasatch County. The overall tally shows Kohler ahead with over 68% of the vote. In the Republican race for U.S. House District No. 1, a seat being vacated by Rob Bishop, the lead vote getter in the county was Blake David Moore. In the district, he leads with 30% of the vote, but is followed close behind by Bob Stevenson. There's also a Democratic primary for District No. 1. Unofficial results showed Darren Perry ahead with 52.5% of the vote. In Summit County, though, he was ahead of opponent Jamie Cheek by only 4 votes. Elsewhere in the GOP race for Attorney General, incumbent Sean Reyes led the statewide vote with over 54% of the ballots. In Summit County, he has a narrower lead, nearly 300 votes ahead of David O. Levitt. In the race for State Senate District 19 to replace the retiring Alan Christensen, John D. Johnson won in Summit County over Johnny Ferry. In the overall district, he has nearly 56% of the vote. The Summit County Clerk's Office said that overall voter turnout in the county was about 44.6%. They also reported a substantial number of ballots have not been counted yet, 800 that came in the mail Tuesday that will not be counted until Thursday. They also haven't counted ballots that were deposited in drop boxes between Monday afternoon and 8 p.m. Tuesday night, and any other ballots they received that are postmarked by Tuesday. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
It's 8:16. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Utah Symphony Utah Opera has announced the appointment of Steve Brosvick as the new president and CEO. He begins his new job August 17th. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning. Congratulations.
Good morning. Thank you, Leslie. It's great to be on, and it's great to be coming to Utah.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about yourself and where you're coming from.
Well, I have been working with orchestras and separately with airlines for my career, so a little bit of a diverse background. But I've really traveled the country with my family, moving to several different orchestras in different communities, and are really looking forward to coming to Utah and relearning a new community and getting used to living in the mountains. And we're coming from Nashville. We've spent 5 years here, and before coming to Nashville, we were in Texas for 13, 10 of those at the Houston Symphony and 3 with the San Antonio Symphony. And moving to a new community is going to be a great opportunity for us to really embrace the partnerships and all the other organizations that we're going to be encountering up there.
Okay, so you're ready for some cold and snow then, huh?
We are. I'm originally from Minneapolis, so I grew up in it. I hear that it's very different snow, so we'll experience that this coming winter. And my wife, Cassandra, spent 6 years up in Rochester, New York, at the Eastman School of Music at the University of Rochester. So she understands snow as well.
Snow and cold, right. Yeah. So why was this, why was this a job you wanted?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about getting back into the president and CEO chair for a long time. I was in that position in San Antonio. And this organization is unique. Utah Symphony, Utah Opera, and the combination with the Deer Valley Music Festival is unique in the country. I love the breadth of the organization, the chance to not only be working with a fantastic symphony, but also a highly acclaimed, respected opera company. And the merger of those two companies really brings together some things that I think we can do together that we couldn't do apart. And then having the presence up in Park City for the festival every summer is really intriguing and inviting. We're really looking forward to getting up there.
So tell us a little bit about what you know about Utah's symphony and opera. I mean, how does it compare with others nationwide? Do most people do this, kind of put the symphony and opera together?
No, it's a fairly unique combination, and it's the largest combination of that type in the country. There are a couple of other combined organizations across the country, but not nearly at the size and scope of Utah Symphony, Utah Opera. Looking at across the country, the Utah Symphony and Opera is, as I mentioned, highly respected. The symphony is one of the very few 52-week full-time orchestras in the country. It's one of maybe 15 of them in the U.S. and Canada. So it puts the symphony and the opera in a very unique position at the highest level of orchestras across the country.
All right. And of course, the COVID restrictions have made symphonies and operas very challenging. How do you continue to move this organization forward when, again, the very popular and profitable summer season was entirely canceled?
It definitely makes things difficult, and you know, certainly I'm moving during a pandemic. I've raised an eyebrow at myself and the mayor a couple of times, but it's also an opportunity to hit the ground running, working with the organization as it's already dealing with these situations and the differences. Every community is different. Every orchestra and its position in the community and its current situation is different. And I'm going to bring what I've learned from doing this work with the pandemic here in Nashville to Utah, but also blend in with the work that's already happening there. And there's great people on the ground already. It's an incredible organization. And what I'm going to do is just dive in and try to help navigate all of this together. There's an incredible amount of support from the board and the community to get the orchestra and the opera back on stage, having live music happening as soon as absolutely possible. And the organization is already working through lots of questions about safety and making sure, you know, both on the stage and in the audience that we can get an audience and musicians back working and listening to music again.
Yeah. Have the seasons been announced then for both the symphony and opera before you arrive?
Seasons had been announced, but of course they're shifting a bit because we have to deal with the reality surrounding us. Of course, the summer season up in Park City at Deer Valley was shifted to next season, and you know, most of the same artists that you saw in this summer will appear next summer. You know, Kristen Chenoweth with Kapathia Jenkins, Kool and the Gang, Beach Boys, etc. It's a great season, and I'm looking forward to hearing it and seeing the venue. But also, there's going to be chamber music happening and some pop-up surprise performances with Utah Opera resident artists around Park City using the Art Pianos for All. You'll have to watch the Facebook page to get the hints to find those. But as we look into the fall at Abravanel Hall and the Capitol Theater, that programming is likely going to change because we can't have the full orchestra on the stage or in the pit. We have to deal with the restrictions of spacing the audiences apart and figuring out what we can manage and what music will actually fit that situation. I think some of the programming will be similar. The concerts may be a little bit shorter without intermissions. We're just trying to figure out how we can navigate through this and bring as much music back as we can. And we have 300 years of repertoire to work with, so there's a lot of possibilities.
Yeah. And so your major job, do you see it as fundraising and then kind of leave the artistic stuff to your other folks?
A huge portion of my position is going to be fundraising, but actually more than that is building partnerships and presence of the organization throughout the community. These organizations are really community-embedded organizations that really serve the community. And let's face it, we actually belong to the community. The people who purchase tickets come to our concerts and support the organizations. So our position is to serve. And I'm going to spend a lot of time working on fundraising, but really building relationships and building presence for the organization across the region. And we have great artistic people. We've got an incredible music director. We've got an incredible artistic director for the opera. And they really know what they're doing. And Toby, the artistic planner, is really helping coordinate all of that. And yes, I'm going to bring some ideas, and I'll want to have some input on the direction of the artistic presence and the community presence of the organization. But that's all going to be in partnership with the people who are already there. There's great work happening, and I don't feel like I need to come in and suddenly change course for everything. One of the reasons I'm coming is, and the appeal is, that there's really incredible work happening. So I'm going to be able to jump in, blend in, find my way with the staff and the artistic parts of the organization, and really kind of blend in and help promote what we're doing.
And I think that you've also got a contract coming up. I think the contract for the existing symphony expiring in 2022. You have some experience then again
with the 21-22 season.
Mm-hmm. You have some experience with
that? Conversations are already happening, of course, around the differences and things that we will have to look at for creating concerts during a pandemic. But then we'll dive into, you know, full negotiations for renewing the contract with the American Federation of Musicians a little bit later on. Right now, we just need to deal with life during a pandemic, and we'll navigate that, and then we'll navigate the future beyond.
All right. And any new programs you anticipate kind of bringing to Utah from your other positions?
Well, there are certainly some projects that I have been involved with that, if they look like they will work for the community or something similar will work for the Salt Lake City and Utah community, we will figure those out. But I've been part of developing several film projects for orchestras, which were really done the other way around. Instead of what's very popular and incredibly effective and wonderful right now is the orchestra playing the film scores live to a lot of very popular films. The projects that I've been involved with have been the other way around. We take phenomenal music, either commissioned or existing, and then create a film to accompany that and to enhance the music, but not to supplant the music or take the primary focus. Some of those projects I would love to bring up to Utah. I also was involved with an incredible project called The Violence of Hope, which in Houston, it was a 10-week project that we developed with 25 other community partners, and we brought instruments that are being restored in Israel, violins and other string instruments that were being played by by prisoners in Holocaust war camps, concentration camps during World War II, and these instruments are being restored and are now able to be played and seen, and it's an incredible story that you can bring to your community and use that story as a launching point to talk about social justice and work that we all need to be doing as human beings in our communities.
Okay. Steve, anything else you'd like to say about you coming to Utah?
Well, let me just say that we are really excited about doing some hiking, about meeting all the people, and that we've actually expanding the people that we've been able to meet on the relationships that we've been able to form already in the process of looking at this position. Are warm, welcoming, and incredible. And, you know, frankly, we are just really looking forward to meeting everybody and a little bit of skiing, too.
Okay. Well, again, congratulations, Steve. And again, you're starting the new job August 17th as the new president and CEO of Utah Symphony, Utah Opera. Thanks again.
Great. Thank you very much. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW News Time 826. Well, Tuesday's primary was an all-male election, meaning no in-person voting took place. Preliminary results are in from Wasatch County, although there are still as many as 3,700 ballots that may need to be counted. KPCW's David Boyle has more on that.
In all, nearly 5,900 ballots have been processed of the more than 9,600 that were sent out to Wasatch County voters. Wasatch County Clerk Cal Griffiths says the county has ballots sit for a few hours before officials open them with gloves in order to prevent the spread of coronavirus to ballot counters. Ballots postmarked on Tuesday will be included in a later count. Tuesday night's incomplete count shows a race separated by less than 30 votes for the Wasatch County Council Heber South seat. Incumbent Kendall Crittenden's 435 votes leads Elizabeth Hokinson's 406. In the Republican primary race for State House District 54, Mike Kohler has captured 68% of the vote over his opponent Randy Favreau, who has 31%. The seat is being vacated by Republican Tim Quinn. The winner of the primary will face off against Democrat candidate Megan Miller in November. A small portion of Wasatch County is included in the state Senate District 16. In that race, Kurt Bramble's 56% places him ahead of Sylvia Andrew. There were no Democratic primaries in Wasatch County. I'm David Boyle, KPCW News.
828, good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, on Monday, Park City leaders released plans to build a new senior center near the skate park. The precise location, that grassy area where a large kid-friendly climbing tree grows. It's also a popular location for the town's younger generation, who often stretch a slack line across. On the phone with a response to the news, I have longtime resident of Park City and a member of the senior community, Cheryl Soschnick. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning, Leslie.
So tell us, are seniors happy about this?
Well, actually, I would say that the seniors are frustrated and confused about this.
Okay, can you expand on that?
Sure. We're frustrated and confused because under the direction of Andy and the city council, we've had a committee that has been working with them to try to find a facility that meets our needs. And we've been meeting with them even through the COVID crisis on Zoom meetings and stuff. And we still had some major differences in about three areas that we hadn't come to any kind of a mutual conclusion of. So this site was actually not approved by the committee. And I personally was blindsided on Monday when they showed up to present these plans. Oh, here comes my cat. to present these plans to us when this plan wasn't actually a viable one yet.
So you're saying that the city jumped the gun here?
I'm afraid they did. I just listened to the news article on what Andy had said, and some of those things are very true about what we've been trying to do, looking for a permanent location and things like that. And it sounds good on the first look, and thank you for doing that. But in actuality, this building that they're proposing has a few areas that we're still working with them on that we can't accept the proposal until we can find answers to this. One of them is the fact that we really, in our present facility, we feel that we own the building. It was given to the senior citizens in 1976 and has been in our possession since then on the city land. And we have a 99-year lease with the city. And to give up the security of where we're at, we need to have some written assurances that the continuation of our staying there is assured for as long as we want, hopefully to the end of the lease, where many other people down the road can enjoy senior facilities. And this actually isn't what they have in plan. Now, they actually have this planned as a temporary facility until they and the county and whoever can come up with another plan to move to a new facility out at the junction or somewhere like that. So it's really not a permanent facility, and they won't give us any kind of written assurances. Every time we talked to them, they said, we're going to have a interlocal agreement with the county. And they said, you can use the building. And that brings up another point, is that we have exclusive use of a senior center, our own senior center right now. And this is not going to be a senior center. This is going to be a building that the city builds that we can use a couple days a week. And then the rest of the time they can use it for whatever purpose the city needs to use. And that's not acceptable to us either, because as we grow, we have already, before COVID, been adding things like art classes and receptions and other gatherings that we could do because the building is ours and we were in control of it. And that wouldn't be the case with the new facility that they're offering to let us use on the 2 days that the seniors actually currently meet, which is Mondays and Thursdays.
Yeah. So tell me, I mean, what is the status of this 99-year lease? I mean, does this need to go to court to have a judge figure out whether or not that lease is enforceable?
Well, you know, down the road, we may have to. We hope we don't have to go there. The seniors have hired a lawyer to discuss with us what's happening, and he has been in communication with the city. But beyond that, it's look at what the intent of this lease was back in 1976 and then back again in 1982. You know, what was the city, what were the citizens of Park City actually trying to do? Were they trying to find a permanent home for the seniors? Yes, they were. And were they trying to help us? Yes, they were. And even if this goes to court, you know, and it gets down to dotting some I's and crossing some T's about, is this legal? We need to look at and think about what the intent is. And a lot of people are hearing about what's been happening. You know, many of the seniors have come out of the woodwork in the last year to rally around us and say, yeah, you know, the city and the people of this town have always supported the seniors, and they need to continue to. And so it's almost a side issue about whether the lease is valid. It's like, what do the people in the city of Park City want to provide for the seniors?
So I'm a little bit confused, I guess, like you are then. I mean, if you were meeting, why is it that the city came out and said, this is what we're going to do if it didn't have buy-off from the senior community?
Absolutely. We don't know. It's like I said, we were blindsided. I don't know what they're trying to do. We were told not to have the public come and talk to them again, like we all did in a city council meeting last fall when we overwhelmed with about 80 to 100 seniors and everybody had their different opinions. And then they said, no, we don't want you to do that. We want you to have a committee to negotiate with us. You represent the seniors. And then out of the blue, they come up with this plan that we actually saw 6 months ago, and we rejected it 6 months ago until we could work on these things that I talked about, plus the size issue. I haven't even mentioned the fact that they are proposing a building that is about the same square footage as what we have. But even if we stay in our current location, well, with the growth of the numbers of seniors that are becoming involved, and now with this whole COVID distancing thing, even the new normal after COVID, who knows how many people we can put around the table. You know, we need to get the county health department involved. It's just all premature, Leslie. We, you know, the size issue is a critical thing, and we don't know the answers yet. And they're offering to build a facility that's just about the same size as we have now. Totally too small.
Except that it's temporary, and they may have some other ideas for the future of that, no?
And we don't want a temporary facility. We're looking for a permanent facility, have been all along.
All right. So, I mean, what happens from here? I know that the city is hosting a few opportunities for information and public input. One of those set for tomorrow from 1
right.
to 2,
mm-hmm.
a drive-through, and then a virtual open house, and also a
right.
virtual...
And I don't know what those are for either, because we've been trying to keep the seniors who are, you know, in the program and that we have email addresses for notified. I don't know what they're expecting to get and why they're turning it back to the public when this wasn't even ready for release yet. But that's there to do. What we're hoping to do is to be able to actually sit down with representatives from the city, the attorneys that we have in theirs, and the planners and the council, and hash it all out and say, what can we do to make this a win-win situation? Leslie, we love the location. We would love to move from where we are to across from across the library near the city park. It's a great location. And that's why if we move in there and we like it and we want to stay, we want to stay. We don't want them to say 3 years from now, okay, you have to move because somebody else is going to build something out at Queens Junction. You know, we want the ability to say, no, we like it here.
Yeah. And I understand.
And it's ours.
Yeah. I understand the location is a convenient one, but it's also at the expense of our area's youth. Right. I mean, it's a really popular place for kids to climb that tree. You know, you see it all the time, as well as that slack line up there. So,
yep, that's true. The tree would have to come down. You're right.
Okay. Cheryl, anything else you want to mention?
I just wanted to say that if any other seniors, you know, the city's having this open house, which I don't understand, but if any of the other seniors want to talk to us, and we do actually need to talk to our own seniors, it's been very hard to do so during this time of COVID. We don't have email addresses for everybody, and it's been really hit and miss, but we really are trying to reach out to those of us who have been interested. And if anybody would like to talk to us about our feelings on this and give us some ideas of how we can get this into a win-win situation with the city, our email address, we have a new one. It's parkcityutahseniors@gmail.com. Just go ahead and email us and we'll put you on our list and we'd be glad to talk to you and wish us luck.
Cheryl Sashik, I appreciate your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:39. It's the local news hour here on KPCW. Well, mask wearing, social distancing, and strict hygiene measures are difficult enough with adults, but what happens when childcare operations are required to follow the COVID-19 safety protocols? KPCW's Carolyn Murray has this update on two local childcare operations.
Creekside Kids Academy and Peak Program Executive Director Brandy Rasmussen says the big challenge with COVID-19 is keeping up with the changes in safety protocols. The mask order applies to children, she says, age 2 and older, which she says is very difficult to enforce.
Everything tends to change regularly, so we're keeping track of what we need to be doing, making sure that that doesn't conflict with our licensing rules, which a lot of them do, and then really just trying to make sure that we've got inclusivity in the classroom so that we can make sure that everybody can follow the same rules and the same protocol. The mask order has been really difficult for our parents and families, just trying to figure out how to make that work in a classroom with children of the ages that we serve.
Rasmussen says they have teachers and children who can't wear masks for different reasons, and it's confusing for young children to understand. They have ordered face shields for the children and teachers and hope to use them instead of masks. They have not arrived yet, and she isn't sure how they'll fit and if it will provide a safer barrier to the virus spreading.
The reason we did the shields was really to help with, you know, kids being able to have access to eating and drinking throughout the day regularly as they need it, keeping the teachers from having to handle masks, keeping the children from swapping masks or, you know, touching each other's masks or putting them on inside out. And, you know, there's a lot of technically like biohazard materials and we're not treating them that way. There's a lot of risk in that.
PC Tots founder and chair Carol Loomis says they're opening this week because parents are desperate for childcare with so many families returning to work.
So we made the difficult decision to open. It has cost us about $25,000 in mitigation for the virus on requirements because one of our buildings had quite open classrooms, and we've had to build 6-foot walls between some of the classrooms, and we've added MERV 13 filters to HVAC. We've put in tower fans in every room. We have to make sure the screens and windows open well so that we can get a lot of airflow. So we're also challenged by the mask ruling, and now the county has the mask provision for children 2 through 5.
Loomis says there is a broader discussion in the childcare industry about masks causing trauma for young children. Summit County Health Director Rich Bulla says there is no directive at the time of this report, and County Council will discuss the issue concerning possible amendments during this week's public meeting. In keeping with best practices, they'll do health assessments and temperature checks on teachers and children daily.
We certainly don't want to be spreading virus, and yet we've got our parents are out in the community and they're servicing our community members. No parents will be coming into the center. They will drop their children at the door. There'll be a health check to see if they have any of the symptoms of the virus. There'll also be temperature checks of the parent and the child.
Currently, PC Tots can accommodate just 35% of the normal attendance. Many families are faced with one parent having to leave their job to care for children. She says the state is offering grants to help pay for some of the losses due to COVID-19. They have received financial assistance from Park City, Summit County, and the Christian Center. Rasmussen says her business has received initial support from the county with PPE supplies, but requirements continue to change.
We did a $5,000 grant that we could apply for to help pay for the cost of some of the PPE, cleaning things, some of the changes that they required. But that was early on, and then they've made quite a few changes since then. that have required similar costs. And I haven't seen anything outside of that first initial $5,000 from the county.
Rasmussen says they are about 70% attendance of the pre-COVID-19 enrollment numbers. I'm Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
8:45 now. Good morning. Well, on the phone with an update from Summit Community Gardens, I have Executive Director Sloan Johnson. Good morning, Sloan.
Good morning, Leslie.
So first, how is the garden growing?
The garden's doing great. We have had some late freezes, which have been a bit of a challenge, but all in all, we've got a lot growing in the garden right now.
Okay. You have started your food stands on Wednesdays. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so our Wednesday farm stand started last week. So every Wednesday from 9 to 12, we'll have a pop-up farm stand at the garden. And these, we're selling whatever we have growing. So this week, you'll find radishes, turnips, arugula, and different lettuces. And then whatever we don't sell at the farm stand, we will donate to the Christian Center. We also are working with the health department on our farm stand this year. And so we're able to take SNAP, WIC, and double up spot for those who need help affording fresh produce.
All right. So is the food from those growing in the garden, or is it a special section of the garden that is used for the farm stand exclusively?
Yeah, so the way our garden's set up is we have 4 demonstration beds, and that's where we grow our food for the farm stand and for donating to the Christian Center, as well as for classes and learning experiences as well. So we have our 4 larger demonstration plots that we grow food for this farm stand.
Okay. And have you been able to figure that out in terms of the gathering restrictions at the garden? I mean, are there any problems of people out there gardening with having too many people at once?
That's a good question. So we haven't had any problems. Everybody has been very mindful of giving space. The garden is a large area. And the way we've done it is we ask that if somebody's working in the garden plot next to you, you give them their space, wait till they're finished. And then go in and do your work in your garden plot. And because the garden's such a wide open space, we're really easily able to spread people apart. And then we also require masks while you're walking in and out of the garden. While you're working in your bed, you don't have to have your mask on. But going in and out of the gate and entering the garden is when we ask you to wear a mask.
All right. And when you talk about the food donations that are being made to the Christian Center, any idea of how much you're providing them?
Yeah. So our goal for this year is 1,500 pounds of fresh produce. So far, with one donation, we've donated 6 pounds. And also we're working on, you know, as we're donating the food, we're really focusing on how to get the food to the people in need. So what we will be doing when we have excess food that's perishable is pickling it as well so that it has a longer shelf life.
All right. You are also offering dinners in the garden. Tell me about these.
Yeah. So this year, because we weren't able to do our big fundraisers, we started a Dinner in the Garden series, which has been awesome. And so last week we had a private chef, Sophia Maletti, that did a 4-course meal in the garden. We limited it to 20 people, and it was amazing. Coming up, we have Versante is hosting a dinner in the garden on July 9th. And so that will also be a nice sit-down meal where they'll be serving you dinner. And for that one, it'll be kind of picnic style. You bring your own chairs, you bring your own drinks, you bring a blanket to sit on the grass. We'll space people out, and we can fit up to 40 people in the garden for that dinner. So that's coming up. Then on July 23rd, we have Devonza's Pizza. We're kind of doing a kind of swing off on pie and beer. We're having pizza pie and then bring your own drink picnic in the garden on July 23rd. And then on July 30th, we have music in the garden. We have Red Desert Ensemble, which is kind of an orchestra that will be playing in the garden on July 30th. So So we have a pretty busy activities in the garden schedule this month.
Right, since you need to limit the number of people, so you're taking RSVPs?
Yes, exactly. So you need to sign up online. All the spaces are limited. We're not having any more than a total of 50 people, and that includes the people that are volunteering and working. So we're selling 40 tickets to these events.
All right, and what's the cost? It just depends on the different week?
Yeah, it depends on the week. So for Sante in the Garden, you're getting a four-course meal, and it's $65 for plot renters and $75 for non-plot renters.
All right, and then, like, what about the Davanza's Pizza?
And Davanza's Pizza will be $40 per person.
All right.
And we'll probably do $45 for non-plot renters.
And then for the Red Desert concert?
And the Red Desert will be donation-based.
All right.
So we'll be asking for about a $25 donation.
Right. You've got a couple of adult education classes coming up. Tell us about those.
Yeah, so we've got some great education classes coming up. On July 14th, we have Beauty and Structure in the Edible Garden, and that'll be taught by Julie Wang. And so basically this class is how to make your garden look good, how to make it feel good. And that will be, yeah, that will be happening on July 14th. And then we have Mindful Cuisine is going to be teaching a canning and pickling class on July 21st. And then in August, we'll be having with Linda Albert and Mindful Cuisine, she's going to do a cooking class, cooking with a vegetable.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
Yeah, and the one other thing we have is we have yoga classes in the garden as well with Whitney Reed. And so we have those every Wednesday morning from 8 to 9 and every Saturday and Sunday from 8:30 to 9:30. So if you want to get in the garden, you know, come to our dinners, come to a yoga class. It's a beautiful place to be. And it's safe. We're able to spread people apart. We're you're outside, and we've been working hard on our COVID protocols as far as wearing masks when you come in and out. And so it's a good, safe place to come out and just enjoy the outdoors.
Okay. Say, Sloan, thanks for your time this morning.
Yeah, thank you so much. Have a great day, Leslie.
That's Sloan Johnson, Executive Director of Summit Community Gardens. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. News Time Now, 8:53. KPCW News Time Now, 8:53. Good morning. Well, as part of their agenda today, the Summit County Council will hear from the developer of Silver Creek Village. KPCW's Rick Bruff reports the application to amend the village's development agreement has run into disagreement from the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission.
The council will hold a public hearing on the application at about 6 p.m. County Manager Tom Fisher said the proposal comes from developer Matt Lowe, but Mountain Lands Community Housing Trust is also involved in the plan.
They're basically asking to amend some heights within the project on a certain parcel, amend the maximum lot size, and change some language on how the housing is calculated for parts of development. I think the idea is that the development that wants to happen on that parcel or that is proposed has a certain footprint to it and height that is already determined by other projects that have happened.
On June 23rd, the Snyderville Planning Commission gave a negative recommendation for Lowe's proposals.
As has been debated in this overall Silver Creek Village project before, the distribution of affordable housing has been an issue with the Planning Commission and the Council. Heights have been an issue. It's very specifically with heights. If you look within the development agreement, there's generally language that talks about the higher density and higher height buildings are in the center of the development, and it gets less dense and lower height buildings as it goes towards the edge of the development, where this parcel within this development is on the edge of the property. So there are some conflicts within the development agreement language and what the developer is proposing.
Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
And John Gay was hired by Deer Valley as a ski school supervisor before the iconic Utah Resort's inaugural season in 1981. He has worked there ever since. This week, he steps down as director of ski services. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more about that.
Friday, July 3rd will mark the last day for one of Deer Valley's original employees. John Gay will retire after nearly 40 years at the same resort. Gay has served as Deer Valley Resort's Director of Skier Services for the last 18 years, a position he took over just after the 2002 Olympics. He was a natural fit for the job. He was there for Deer Valley's first ever opening day, all the way back in 1981. Gay says those early years were exciting, but filled with uncertainty. He was in charge of booking lessons and taking reservations for the ski school back then and saw lots of employee turnover as Deer Valley was working out how to best run their business.
Until you really open the doors and the guests show up and you're kind of in the front lines, I'm not sure if you were, any of us were really quite certain how it was all going to go. And we were pretty busy right out of the gate. High demand for lessons, you know, families on vacation, mom and dad like to take privates and the kids in group lessons, and it just took off from there.
In the pre-internet and computer days, Gay did all of the reservations by hand with pencil and paper and a massive binder of instructors and schedules. Gay says his system from the 80s was actually used as the template for how electronic reservations are handled at the resort today. According to Gay, apart from modern technology, the core business of today's Deer Valley is very similar to when he first started on day one at the resort. He says high-quality service, small crowds, and great food have always been centerpieces of the Deer Valley experience. Gay says starting next week, he's going to take some time for himself and his family to reflect on his lengthy career. After that, it's traveling, camping, kiteboarding, and of course a little skiing from here on out. He says, all things considered, hobbies and grandkids will keep him pretty busy.
I feel really, really fortunate that I was able to, you know, kind of be in on the ground floor and the startup of a really successful business. You know, I think a world-class business. And I think the people that have been here, the people that have stuck with it, I mean, there was a lot of turnover in the early years and people that really weren't probably the right fit for this type of company. But the ones that stuck it out and the ones that, you know, kind of poured their hearts and souls into it are some great people. And the group from the first year is getting to be a little bit small now, but we have so many people that have been here for 20, 25 years. And just my thanks to all the frontline staff, to my managers that worked in Skier Services, the director group. Just a really, really great resort.
The search to fill Gay's role is currently underway. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
And the Park City Mountain Resort is reopening for a summer season tomorrow, about 3.5 months after it closed down due to the coronavirus outbreak. The resort COO, Mike Gore, told us they'll be offering a resort experience, but also focusing on safety for their staff and guests. The Mountain Resort closed for the winter season March 15th. He said that opening for the summer season and preparing for the winter to come in the face of a pandemic is something he has never experienced in his career. He detailed what will be open tomorrow as they head into a holiday weekend.
So we're going to have the Crest and Payday lifts open. Crest will be open for sightseeing and by call. Payday will be open for hiking, sightseeing, and of course access to the Alpine Slide. The Mountain Coaster will also be open. Golf out of Canyons Village opened on Friday. Food and beverage out of the Park City Village will be Jupiter Java with grab-and-go items. We will not be preparing food, at least for now. We'll monitor how all of that works, and then we'll see how we continue to build on that as the summer goes along.
For the reopening, they will be requiring masks, not only for staff, but all guests. And he said they were planning that even before the county's mandatory mask order. He said work on the resort was more complicated given the need to watch out for COVID-19. 100% of the staff will undergo daily health screenings, including questionnaires and temperature checks. Looking ahead 5 months, he said he's confident that they can open for skiing and snowboarding. He says they will have some guidance. Vail has 3 resorts in Australia, and he says they're figuring out right now how to operate with proper crowd management and social distancing. Meanwhile, he says they are selling passes. This year, the passes have an insurance feature.
A little bit different than insurance, but if a listener were to go onto parkcitymountain.com, look at the Epic Pass page, they can see all of those benefits. But that coverage provides for refunds if the resort closes due to COVID or any other reason, but particularly it addresses the pandemic. And there are additional benefits within that coverage, including injury, loss of job, etc. It's really very comprehensive and one of a kind in our industry.
That's Mike Gore, Chief Operating Officer of Park City Mountain. This is KPCW Park City.